The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Actually, with Richard Palmer. Hello and welcome to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. That's the stinger we usually play, or we don't usually play when Mr. Flurry is not speaking. But he's asked me to take the show today, though I believe he will be back on tomorrow. Well, why is America a great power? What allows it to really project power all around the world? It's something we've talked about before on this show, but one vital prerequisite for America to be able to project power around the world is control of the Caribbean Basin. American geopolitical thinker Professor Nicholas Spikeman, he, in his book, which I have right here, there we go, America's Strategy in World Politics, that he published, I think, in 1943, explained that America was able to become a world power only when she controlled the Caribbean, which he called America's Mediterranean. And he also explained how South America is also very important for the security of the United States. This is America's back door. You know, the U.S. occupying the best, the prime, the most dominant real estate in the Americas is in a very secure position. And the only thing it really needs to worry about is foreign nations getting a foot in its back door in Latin America. And we'll come back to the importance of that later. But right now, I just wanted to review just a whole ton of different news articles that have come out in the last couple of weeks or so about exactly that, foreign nations getting a foothold in America's back door. And we'll talk in the second half of the show just about how profoundly dangerous this is. But I'll just start going through some of these articles because there are quite a lot of them. We'll start with Mexico, with its large land border just to the south of the United States. And on Friday, the Boston Globe published an article titled "Waking the Mexican Sleeping Giant." And they wrote that with a barrage of insults and threats, President Trump has begun the process of turning Mexico against us. This could bring the United States something it never had: an unfriendly country on our border. Now, I think "never had" is quite clearly a bit of an exaggeration there. He does go on to talk about some of that history. But just to get back to this quote, it says, "In his rhetoric, Mr. Trump has unleashed the potent force of Mexican nationalism. One result of this rising defiance may be the election next year of the first truly anti-Yankee president in American history. That would threaten our dominance of the Caribbean Basin and profoundly alter our geopolitical position." Now, I think there is some anti-Trump bias in that author there, and the way you see Mexico, or the way you see nationalism rising around the world, it's certainly, even regardless of Donald Trump, no surprise to see that rising in Mexico. But regardless of any political biases the author may have, the geopolitics is spot on. America is increasingly becoming anti-American, and as he wrote, that does threaten our dominance of the Caribbean Basin and profoundly alter our geopolitical position. And so he goes on to talk about how that next potential anti-American president, the current president, whose name I'm not really going to even try and pronounce, he's celebrated among some in the left in America as someone who will stand up to Mr. Trump. For example, he cancelled his planned trip to Washington in response to some of the things Mr. Trump has been saying and doing there regarding the southern border. But his approval rating is 12%. Because in Mexico, he is seen as being way too pro-American. And this article, going back to this article from the Boston Globe, it says the first beneficiary may be Mexico's leftist firebrand, Andre Manuel López Obrador. He lost the last two presidential elections, most recently by a narrow margin, possibly provided by fraud. But suddenly he has risen from the political ashes and claimed the mantle of Mexican patriotism. In campaign speeches, he rails at Trump for treating Mexicans, quote, like dirt and vows to end his country's subordination to the United States and brings crowds to ecstasy by shouting, "Everything depends on strengthening Mexico so we can confront aggression from abroad." And then this article writes, "Imagine a version of the late President Hugo Chavez of Venezuela, the most outspoken anti-US leader to emerge from Latin America in this century, on our southern border. That's what it looks like we could be heading for." And then this article points out that if Mexico does want to oppose the US, it would have no shortage of friends in trying to do that. Any nation that wants to challenge or threaten the United States would be eager to deal with an anti-American Mexico right there, ready to, in prime position to threaten the United States. And going back to this article, it says they might even decide that since the United States so eagerly pushes its military power to the borders of unfriendly countries, Mexico should play the same game, inviting a Chinese ship to refuel at the Manzanillo naval base or hosting a Russian military delegation would show Americans how it feels to live with provocative saber-rattling next door. It might also set off a serious US-Mexico confrontation. And then this article concludes that this whole situation could bring a hostile power to the US border for the first time in modern history. So that's a major potential development there in Mexico. But with those developments in Mexico, you don't even need to wait for a potential new president. Kieran Underwood wrote an article that went up on thetrumpet.com on February 13th titled, "Who Will Mexico Trade With Now?" And this article says, when Mexico is having trade troubles with the United States, or with United States President Donald Trump, where should it turn? Based on recent developments, the answer is Europe. On February 1st, Mexican and European officials agreed to work on modernizing an existing free trade pact. The negotiation of this pact, worth $57 billion in 2015, have to be sped up. And they're going to have additional meetings now in April and June to work on speeding up this free trade pact. And he writes, why the sudden move to improve Europe-Mexico relations? Donald Trump. And he talks about how Mr. Trump has said that that NAFTA, that North American Free Trade Agreement, is the worst trade deal maybe ever signed anywhere, but certainly ever signed in this country. So he's obviously not a huge fan of America's trade with Mexico. He said that every in his inauguration speech, he said that every decision on trade, on taxes, on immigration, on foreign affairs will be made to benefit American workers and American families. We must protect our borders from the ravages of other countries making our products, stealing our companies, destroying our jobs. And so he's talked about, he's raised the prospect of large tariffs. He's discouraged companies from building factories in Mexico and threatened to punish those that do. And, of course, he's talked about building that wall there and getting Mexico to pay for it. So Mexico is concerned and they want leverage. Now, that's not necessarily going to be easy for Mexico to do that and to put that into practice. As you would expect, their trade is absolutely dominated by the United States. For example, their trade with the United States is around $600 billion in goods, while with EU trade with Mexico was only around 50, 60 billion. So one-tenth of Mexico's trade with America. However, since 2005, European-Mexican trade volume has more than doubled, so they're going up. Mexico is trying to diversify its trade, find other nations to trade with, so it's not as dependent upon the United States. And so it's looking to Europe. It's also looking to China. And earlier in the month, the AP had an article titled "Facing Trump Trade Threats, Mexico Turning to China, EU for New Partnerships." And this article states, with NAFTA under threat, China appears as an attractive alternative with its mass market of 1.37 billion people. And again, I think this was right at the start of February it was written. On Wednesday, the government unveiled a $212 million joint investment between China automaker JAC Motors and Mexico's Giant Motors. And anyway, it goes on to talk about how Mr. Trump is threatening to impose high tariffs on car companies that manufacture cars in Mexico and export them to the U.S. And so this article talks about, well, how China's or Mexico's looking, okay, well, can we sell cars to China instead? And the governor of this province where the trade deal was signed said, when you can't look only to the north, you can look to the east. And China is already Mexico's second biggest trade partner, still a long way behind the United States, $75 billion in goods exchanged in 2015. And the Chinese president, he's visited China several times since 2012. They signed a strategic partnership when Xi Jinping visited Mexico in 2013. Now, there are still quite a few obstacles to overcome. Mexico imports a whole ton more from China than it does export to China, and exporting to China is much more difficult than exporting to the United States, and then there's just much more transport costs and things like that. So it's not like this will be a simple flick of the switch and tomorrow Mexico will be trading 10 times more with China than they are with the United States. But they are definitely looking to shift their relations now. They're looking for other allies. They're looking for trade allies. They're looking for just allies on the world scene. And they're trying to diversify, and they're actively looking for alternatives to the United States. Now, going further south, another country that could very soon possibly provide an excellent opportunity for a foreign power to gain a foothold on what Spikeman called America's Mediterranean, just this body of water that's hugely important for the United States, for their position in the world, there could also be another opportunity in Venezuela. Now, the regime there seems on the brink of collapse. Here's a few quick quotes from this weekend Spectator. They write, across the country, supermarkets are empty, and most ordinary people queue for hours every day just for flour. Many of the animals in Caracas Zoo have starved to death, but even those who survive aren't safe. Venezuelans have taken to raiding the cages to butcher and eat whatever they can find. So people are so desperate for food, they're raiding the zoo. It also notes that inflation is expected to pass a mind-blowing 2,200% this year. Now, the focus of this article was on how socialists around the world, and especially people like our very own Jeremy Corbyn over in Britain, have heaped praise upon Hugo Chavez and his socialist regime, and how socialism has turned out to be an absolute disaster, which is all true. But it's also important geopolitically. If America has a failed state on the other side of this American Mediterranean, on the other side of the Caribbean, that's going to have some ramifications. And we've seen what this has done for Europe with Libya and how it can export instability across the region. Now, if America plays its cards right, it could benefit hugely from the fall and the decline of this enemy state. But, as the case of Gaddafi in Libya demonstrated, the fall of an enemy strongman isn't necessarily a great thing for you. It can be if you use it well, and America, as I said, could, I think, increase their power if they do things well, but they haven't typically in recent times. And just like in Libya, the fall of a hard man could provide opportunities for other powers to start to get involved in the region. And so in this case, any kind of post-socialist Venezuela, if the regime does collapse, they would probably end up looking a lot like Cuba last year, where Cuba is just doing more and more deals with Europe. The Pope's been to visit there, and they've really building up ties with the Catholic Church, and then they're trying to really build up trade ties with the European Union. And last year we had an article on this for the Trumpet website. And it says, if Maduro's regime collapses, we can expect people like Henrique Capriles to fill the leadership void in Venezuela. Capriles is an avowed, staunch Catholic, educated at the Catholic University in Caracas. He has challenged Maduro before in the presidential elections of April 2013. While campaigning for those elections, he stated that the first thing he would do after winning is pay homage to the Virgin Mary. In November 2013, Capriles had a private audience with Pope Francis in which he pleaded for the Vatican's intervention in the political crisis in Venezuela. So a fall of a regime there in Venezuela would probably open up, or Europe would probably be very eager and very quick to get involved on just another country on that Caribbean rim that's going to be closely connected to America's trade, America's economy, as we'll get into the second half. And it was in Venezuela in 1902 that Germany attempted to use to gain a foothold and a naval base in the Caribbean basin. as an ability to be able, as an opportunity to be able to project power against the United States. So expect Europe to draw closer there, depending on how things play out in terms of the end game of Maduro's regime. But this goes beyond just one or two countries. Since Donald Trump's election, the whole region has been reevaluating its trade connections. And so we see, for example, just to go to another news story, the whole region trying to get together more as a united trade bloc. Stratfor had an article published within the last couple of weeks called "As NAFTA Stumbles, Mercosur Senses Opportunity." And they write, "To say that relations between Mexico and the United States are tense is an understatement. With major tussles looming over the proposed construction of a border wall and over the North American Free Trade Agreement, other trade partners sense opportunity." To be clear, NAFTA talks are not necessarily going to collapse. There is still a long way to go before that could occur, and much is still uncertain. Regardless, members of Mercosur, a trade bloc thousands of kilometers to the south of NAFTA, are already cozying up with Mexico to secure their spot should NAFTA fall apart. Brazil and Argentina, the two largest Mercosur economies, are leading this push. Later this month, Brazilian officials will engage in talks with their Mexican counterparts on exporting more soybeans, beef, and pork to Mexico. Argentina will follow up with similar visits in April. So Mercosur senses an opportunity, and it looks like the fall of Donald Trump's trade policies could really hasten a unified economic bloc forming within Latin America as they try to form deeper trade ties with each other to help make up for some of the lost trade with the United States. But then powers outside the region sense an opportunity as well. Bloomberg has an article titled "Germany's Merkel Would Welcome South American Trade Deal with EU." And I'll just read a couple of paragraphs from this article. It says German Chancellor Angela Merkel said she would welcome a free trade agreement between South America and the European Union, further signaling her rejection of the protectionist stance being taken by US President Donald Trump. A deal could include agriculture and energy, Merkel said Saturday in her weekly vodcast. She singled out Uruguay as a member of the Mercosur trade bloc. I'm guessing vodcast stands for a video podcast. It also sounds like some kind of vodka cocktail. Don't know, maybe a podcast while someone's drinking vodka, but I doubt that's what Merkel's doing. Anyway, she singled out Uruguay as one member of Mercosur trade bloc that's supporting closer ties with the EU ahead of President Tabira Vecchio's visit to Berlin on February 8th. Oh, here we go. Our producers just put up on the screen that vodcast is another term for video cast. So there you go. Anyway, just one more quote from Merkel. She said, "First, it would be important now to start talking to each other again." So she's all for Europe now, pushing in and pushing to make a trade deal with the whole region. Now, one common thread on this subject is the failure of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. We've talked before how Mr. Trump has pulled away from that. And we've usually talked about this more in terms of the United States and Asia, and about how America pulling away from that TPP has meant that countries of Southeast Asia, countries like Australia and New Zealand as well, are looking for alternative trade deals to replace the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. But a lot of South American states were involved in the TPP as well. And so just like Australia, just like New Zealand, just like all those states of Southeast Asia, they're looking for alternatives. They're in the same boat. And so this article notes that Merkel and Chinese President Li Keqiang spoke in favor of closer ties last month in a call between the leaders of the world's number one and number three exporters. Germany will host in July a summit of group of 20 leaders in the port city of Hamburg, gateway to the world for German high-end goods from Siemens machinery to BASF chemicals, and the entry point for Chinese goods. So you can start. We've talked before a lot on this program about the building of that German-China axis, and you can certainly see how Latin America could be very easily drawn in to this axis. And going back to another point, another article now, more directly on that TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership, this time from the agency France Press. They have a title, and this is from today, actually, "EU Profits as Trump Turns Away from Trade." And so this states, "The United States' new hostility to free trade deals under President Donald Trump is benefiting the European Union," the bloc's top trade officials said Tuesday. After Trump's withdrawal from the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal in late January, many countries are now turning to us, to Europe, Because they believe protectionism is not the right answer, European Commissioner Cecilia Malmström told German business news Hansablatt. So as TPP fails, we've talked about nations turning to China, they're also turning to the EU. We are already negotiating with almost all of them, or preparing conversations with the countries around the Pacific Rim that had signed up to the US-led treaty, she went on. Since Trump's election, the commission has sped up talks with Mexico, South American trade bloc Mercosur, and Japan, and is preparing possible talks with Australia and New Zealand, and has a completed deal with Vietnam on the table, Malmström noted. We have a well-stocked pipeline, she said. So Europe has a well-stocked pipeline of deals that they're getting ready to put together now as these countries look to replace the TPP. So Europe's really getting ready to capitalize on the Trump opportunity for trade, and especially in Latin America. I'll just talk about one more news article on this subject. This one is called China Eyes Latin America in Ashes of Monroe Doctrine. And this is an article from America Economa. It's translated into English by World Crunch. And I'm sure all of our listeners are very familiar with the Monroe Doctrine. So knowing just how vital this region of the Caribbean, of Latin America, is to U.S. history, America very early on produced the Monroe Doctrine as one of its most fundamental guiding principles of foreign policy. President Monroe said the American continents are henceforth not to be considered as subjects for future colonization by any European powers. The most kind of modern statement of it comes from the Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberg, who said there should be no interference, no sponsorship of any kind of military activity in this hemisphere by countries of other hemispheres. So this Monroe Doctrine has been America blocking other powers from getting involved in Latin America and in the Caribbean. And this article is called China Eyes Latin America in the Ashes of the Monroe Doctrine. And this article mentions, and I'll just go into a little more detail on this, on how under Mr. Obama, America effectively ended the Monroe Doctrine. And we wrote about this on The Trumpet. Here's a clip from John Kerry in 2013 pronouncing this historic guiding principle of American foreign policy over.
In the early days of our republic, the United States made a choice about its relationship with Latin America. President James Monroe, who was also a former Secretary of State, declared that the United States would unilaterally and as a matter of fact act as the protector of the region. The doctrine that bears his name asserted our authority to step in and oppose the influence of European powers in Latin America. And throughout our nation's history, successive presidents have reinforced that doctrine and made a similar choice. Today, however, we have made a different choice. The era of the Monroe Doctrine is over. The relationship, that's worth applauding. It's not a bad thing.
I mean, the arrogance of that is just astounding, that this, you know, for the better part of 200 years, this has been the guiding principle of American foreign policy. And it's just dismissed, you know, oh, well, yep, that's worth applauding. That's over, as if it was just some kind of cruel, inhumane thing America did for no reason. Now, Mr. Obama, he also confirmed that Monroe Doctrine is over. He said in 2005, the days in which our agenda in this hemisphere so often presumed that the United States could meddle with impunity, those days are past. So to him, America acting on this existential threat, you know, as we'll go into more in the second half, America cannot be a major power without being secure in this region. It cannot be a global power without being secure in this region. And you know, ending that fundamental defense that America needs by just saying, well, we're not going to meddle anymore. And there's just a huge amount of arrogance in just assuming that everybody else was just so obviously wrong in doing that for 200 years. But anyway, back to this article, China Eyes Latin America in Ashes of Monroe Doctrine. And the quip was, first with Obama, now with Trump. The U.S. is making space for a second imperialist power on the American continent, China. And this article states, Donald Trump's arrival at the White House will have real effect on the international system as a whole and will inevitably impact the Latin American region. The key question is, will we continue alone under the US doctrine or make a strategic adjustment? Chile's foreign minister, Geraldo Munoz, has declared that with Trump's pulling out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Pact, Chile must look elsewhere, to China and South Korea. Asking epochal questions is absolutely valid right now for all of Latin America and the Caribbean. So maybe he's saying, well, yep, the end, this epoch of the Monroe Doctrine is over. We need to ask these big questions about allying with foreign powers. Going back to this article, it said in 2009, the US began a process of adjustment and withdrawal, which has prompted an important debate on its consequences. The Trump presidency will deepen the debate as it pushes US foreign policy closer to an autarkic model. So first, as we said, you had Mr. Obama pulling out of the region, and now with Mr. Trump's trade policies, they're effectively having the same effect. And so it writes, in that context, Latin America is experiencing, perhaps without understanding it, China's advance in what is still considered the US backyard. And this author writes, I myself take it as a given that China has completed its process of ascension, and is now, especially since the outcome of the last US election, in a phase of consolidation. In this stage, China's foreign policy is being perceived as aggressive by its own neighbors and beyond. Yet, even if today China is still not openly challenging six decades of US supremacy in Latin America, one may observe it duly encouraging a new type of participation in the region. And then it talks about the China CELAC Forum, CELAC being a Caribbean trade bloc that was inaugurated in 2015 that was discussing closer ties between the region. And then in 2016, China opened up the China Construction Bank in Latin America. That was opened in Chile. And that was aimed at encouraging the use of the renminbi, of China's currency, instead of the dollar in trade, which is something, you know, that would have a huge, if that really takes on, have a huge impact in bringing that region away from the United States into China. It also writes, another area is arms sales. Slowly but systematically, China has developed a policy of presenting itself as a reliable supplier of arms. This is a reality in Chinese foreign policy today and has evolved from modest agreements to sales of sophisticated arms systems in the region. So really now you see this almost perfect storm building in Latin America. Under Mr. Obama, the US stepped back, officially saying the Monroe Doctrine is over, which effectively gives the green light to China and all these other powers around the world, saying they can do what they want in Latin America with much less American opposition. Then within the last few years, you've had socialist regimes have been collapsing over there due to all of those just economic contradictions and the fact that it just doesn't work. They've been collapsing, and that's been bringing to power governments that are more open to trade, governments that are more palatable to Europeans. And now you have Donald Trump ending America's influence in the region by cutting back on its trade and by his anti-trade rhetoric, forcing all of these nations in this region to look abroad. And this is really building to a major trend that we're seeing very quickly, just a month or two in to Mr. Trump's presidency. We'll take a short break, and when we come back, we'll look more deeply at why this trend is so dangerous.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Revelation 6 stands out as an important chapter because of how it locks in with another one of Jesus Christ's prophecies. The glorified Christ revealed these future events to John in Revelation 6. And it was Jesus Christ as a human being, God in the flesh, who prophesied these same events in Matthew 24, the same Christ. In the traditional Christian world, we hear a lot about Christ as our sacrifice, our Savior. But how about Jesus Christ the prophet? That's exactly what he was. His gospel and his whole message revolved around prophecy. So to know Christ means to know about the prophecies he spoke in Revelation and in Matthew. This free booklet, The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, shows that what Christ prophesied in Matthew 24 is primarily for the end time. For more than five decades, Herbert W. Armstrong declared a powerful and consistent warning about the dramatic fulfillment of end-time prophecy. Using the Bible as his guide, Mr. Armstrong made bold predictions about the course of world events long before they occurred. He Was Right encapsulates what he boldly proclaimed for more than 50 years. This free booklet will build your faith in the certainty of biblical prophecy. Request He Was Right and The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. Both booklets are offered free of charge at no cost or obligation to you. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
Hello and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We've been talking about Latin America and how this region under Donald Trump is starting to look to Europe, look to China, look to foreign powers, and how foreign influence is building in that region. Now, in this section, I want to look at how why that is dangerous, why everyone in America especially should be concerned about this trend. And we've talked about trade wars on this program before, and this region is really on the front line of those wars. It's a region where America has been super dominant, and now China and Europe have been moving in. And I quoted earlier from Nicholas Spikeman talking about how control of America's Mediterranean, that Caribbean, is a prerequisite to the United States projecting power around the world and a real key to America's security. Well, just to read a little more from Spikeman and from his book, America's Strategy in World Politics. Here he writes that no serious threat against the position of the United States can arise from in the region itself, talking about the Caribbean basin. The islands are of limited size, and the topology of Central America, like that of the Balkans Peninsula and the European Mediterranean, favors small political units. Even the countries of large size, like Mexico, Colombia, and Venezuela, are precluded by topography, climate, and absence of strategic raw materials from becoming great naval powers. The supremacy of the United States in this area can therefore be challenged only by forces from outside the zone, either in South America or in Europe or Asia. And so he talks about then the importance of America dominating this region and locking those other powers out. Because if those powers are locked out, America is relatively secure. However, because of the importance of keeping those other powers out, he warns that only a very skillful diplomacy and a very thick velvet glove will be able to make the reality of the power relationship tolerable to our good neighbors. And so he talks about just how, because of America will naturally be so dominant in that region, other powers there would resent that, and they would look for allies and look for ways to oppose Americans' dominance by reaching out to those powers from outside the region. Now, I don't think, no matter how much people may support Mr. Trump, that you could characterize him as being one with very skillful diplomacy and a very thick velvet glove. So there are dangers in running around this region like a bull in a china shop, as Spikeman points out. Now, this is talking about just about the Caribbean region, not Latin America as a whole, and we'll go to that earlier. But this vulnerability here and this need to control this region is something that Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry has drawn attention to. We'll listen to a bit of a longer clip in A Key of David that he gave in 2015, and he was quoting from an article by George Friedman, but then just really builds and expands on that, on the dangers of foreign influence in this Caribbean region.
Here is an excerpt from The Geopolitics of U.S.-Cuba Relations by George Friedman, taken from his Geopolitical Weekly, December 23rd, 2014. Now, I want to read you this important statement about what he says about this deal. Quote, after the Soviet Union tried to deploy intermediate-range ballistic missiles there, a new layer was created in which Cuba was a potential threat to the American mainland as well as to trade routes or trade routes. The agreement between the United States and the Soviet Union included American guarantees not to invade Cuba and Soviet guarantees not to base nuclear weapons there. That was the agreement. But there's also a danger, if they get control of Cuba, of interfering mightily with trade routes and trade embargoes and that type thing. Because you can control a lot of that from Cuba. And did you know in your Bible, it also prophesies that there's going to be a siege that is going to do just unimaginable damage to the house of Israel in the end time. And now our booklet on He Was Right explains that in great detail. And you need to understand that because that's another dimension to what could happen if our enemy or our lovers, let's say, get control of Cuba. It is our lovers that is going to do us damage, not Russia or China. And that is prophesied too. Notice what Friedman wrote, since the Louisiana Purchase, Cuba has been a potential threat to the United States when held by or aligned with a major European power. A major European power. Now, when Cuba was ruled by Spain, Cuba was played a central role in controlling all the wealth of Spain. And he concludes by saying, but moments pass and no one can guarantee that it will not become important again. Therefore, the U.S. policy has been to insist on a regime change before releasing pressure. And of course, now they've removed that pressure. And look out and see what is going to happen in Cuba.
So this whole region is absolutely central to American trade. And Cuba is the largest island there. And just strategically located close to that port of New Orleans at the mouth of the Mississippi. That's just an incredibly valuable real estate for controlling American trade. And so America's enemies have repeatedly attempted to gain footholds in this region because this is really the best place if you want to gain a foothold, if you want to challenge, if you want to confront the United States. So, for example, Napoleon put together plans. The island of Saint-Domingue, that's basically the island that split between Haiti and the Dominican Republic today. There was a bit of a rebellion there. He sent a general to go quell the rebellion, but then he said, quell the rebellion, but then use that island as a base to deploy in New Orleans and to invade America. And he failed to put down that rebellion. And once that happened, well, then without a base in the Caribbean, Napoleon completely gave up on his idea of invading America. And so then he sold the Louisiana Purchase, that Louisiana territory, to the United States. He decided that without a base in the Caribbean, he couldn't succeed. But a major effort there by a foreign power to use that region to project power into the United States. And then Kaiser Wilhelm II of Germany, about 100 years later, he wanted to do the same kind of thing. He had plans to establish a commercial empire in Latin America. And again, Kaiser and the Kaiser and his war planners, they felt that the key to accomplishing this was, again, a major Caribbean base. And they identified either Cuba or Puerto Rico as being good candidates for this. And they were blocked by Theodore Roosevelt, a president perhaps more than anybody except President Monroe, associated with this Monroe Doctrine. And he even had to come just within hours with war with Germany in 1902 after Germany attacked Venezuela, where they had plans to establish a military base there in order to begin this projection of power into the Caribbean so they could threaten the United States. And Roosevelt acted very quickly and he was able to force them to back down. And in 2002, historians discovered that during that Venezuelan crisis, German strategists had drawn up several plans for a surprise attack on the American coast, one of which used Puerto Rico as a staging post. Now, ultimately, they shaved those plans because they believed they couldn't win a war against America under Roosevelt. So they were never put into action, and a good part of that was because they couldn't gain those bases in the Caribbean that they needed. And then you saw the same kind of thing during World War One, when Germany was looking for ways to threaten America. Well, where did they turn? They turned again to this region. And this time they turned to Mexico. Before and during World War One, they funded, and Germany funded and trained Mexican soldiers. They tried repeatedly to incite war between Mexico and the United States. It operated spy rings and things like that out of Mexico. And the Zimmerman telegram was just, you know, the most famous of several attempts to persuade Mexico to join the war. And they tried to persuade, they promised Mexico generous financial support if they conquered Texas, New Mexico, and Arizona. And that was one of the things that helped bring, of course, America into World War One. Now, Mexico then was weak. It was in the middle of a civil war. So even with Germany's backing, they knew that they couldn't pull that off. But a much stronger Mexico may well have thought otherwise. And then in much more recent memory, you had the Cuban Missile Crisis, where you had the Russians this time and the Soviets establishing that missile base. And this was... This shows that in some ways the Monroe Doctrine is just more important than ever. You know, had Kaiser Wilhelm managed to carry out his invasion plans, you know, his plan was to capture a few American cities and then force America to negotiate from a position of weakness and force America to allow Germany a permanent Latin American presence and colonies there. But when the nuclear weapons, the stakes aren't temporary annexation of a few cities as part of a bargaining process. It's the existence of everybody on the continent under threat. And Mr. Fleury wrote about this. The Cuban Missile Crisis turned out to be a victory for America, a victory that could so easily have been a crushing defeat. But it proved how strategic the Cuban Islands are for anyone who wants to harm the U.S. With modern weapons, how easily and quickly an enemy force can strike America and its cities. So this whole region, Latin America, has proven repeatedly to be very important for defending the United States. And yet now you have, previously you had the Obama administration talking as if the Monroe Doctrine that protected that region from foreign powers, as if it were just like a waste of time or imperialistic hubris. And you've seen the Cuba deal, something Mr. Fleury called the deadly dangerous Cuba deal, where America is just taking, as we heard from Mr. Fleury, taking the pressure off Cuba without forcing them to change to a friendly regime. And you've got this unfriendly regime now able to make ties all around the world. But this is the real fact of history, the real world. You know, nations, they're rich and jealous of powerful rivals, or they're jealous of rich and powerful rivals. They look for weaknesses. They look for ways to bring them down. And the Caribbean is one of the key ways to try and do that with the United States. And so repeatedly they've tried to get influence in that area. Repeatedly America has blocked them. But that is ending now. Mr. Obama's ending that, and then Mr. Trump is not even, I don't think, thinking in that direction. You can also see just this change in American thinking with the Panama Canal. Theodore Roosevelt built the Panama Canal so Americans could, or America, or part of the reason was so America could quickly move its ships between the Pacific and the Atlantic, which would then give the American Navy the freedom to concentrate its firepower wherever it was needed. And now America's given away the canal. They've shut down its major military bases in Panama. It seems that they don't think they need to even worry about anything as old-fashioned as enemy powers. And Mr. Fleury, it was a really powerful article in the year 2000 when America was giving that away after 100 years before having worked so hard to build it. It was called The Rise and Fall of a Superpower. And Mr. Fleury wrote, "Building the Panama Canal was one of the greatest chapters in American history. It helps to reveal how America became a superpower if we understand the complete history. Today we see an almost totally different spirit in our leaders. The meaning behind that change contains the strongest warning ever for America. And certainly we do see that totally different spirit in American leaders, no longer even worrying about threats to the nation." And you compare that kind of spirit to Mr. Kerry, to Mr. Obama, happily declaring the Monroe Doctrine is over, saying, oh, yep, well, that's something to applaud about. Or even Mr. Trump. And this article, Mr. Flurry also writes, history did prove that the U.S. would lose the canal as our leadership got weaker and weaker. Now watch and see what a disaster the Panama Canal becomes for the U.S. Few of our people are deeply concerned about the canal today. That is another sign we've lost our world vision and are bogged down in a greedy present. I predict, based on history and the Bible, that the Panama Canal area will be a great curse to America in the near future. And that curse has begun already. So we need to watch for threats from that area. And in just May last year, China bought up the largest port in Panama. It was bought by a company called Landbridge Group. And we wrote on our website at the time that the Margarita Island port on the canal's Atlantic side offers the company intimate access across one of the most important goods distribution centers in the world. And this is the same Chinese company with strong links to the Chinese government that bought the port of Darwin in Australia. And this article concluded, keep abreast of China's interest in ports and sea gates around the world. Landbridge's purchase is just one of many Chinese maneuvers to consolidate power over the world's most crucial trade routes. And we see America allowing that consolidation of power over these crucial trade routes right in its backyard. So much of America's trade goes through that Caribbean region. The U.S. is just allowing other powers to come in and threaten to cut off that trade. And as we've talked about, that proximity to America makes this whole region a military threat as well. Now, further south into Latin America, the situation is a little bit different. Once you get south of the equator in Latin America, the region is no longer so intimately connected with the United States and with American trade. There's not that unifying ocean or sea of the Caribbean Sea. Instead, you've got thick jungle blocking the region off. So it is a little different. I'll just quote a couple of points on this point from Robert Kaplan's book, The Revenge of Geography. And he writes that Spikeman saw the separation of the United States from southern South America as of considerable geographical importance. It was a strategic advantage in that the U.S. did not have to master the region the way it had to master the Caribbean basin, but it was a vulnerability in that the U.S. had no special geographical advantage in the event of the region being threatened from an adversary from Europe. And just to go back to Spikeman's book, if I can figure out where I've put that. There we go. On this same subject, he writes, but the fact remains that the temperate zone of the southern continent lies too far away from the center of power, from the center of our power, to be easily intimidated by measures short of war. The result is that the nations of the extreme south enjoy a sense of relative independence from the United States, which the smaller political units of the American Mediterranean can never possess. The ABC states, Argentina, Brazil, Chile, represent a region in the hemisphere where our hegemony, if challenged, can be asserted only at the cost of war. So if another power gains a foothold in the region, it's much harder for America to push it out of that region. America, as Kaplan put it, has no special geographical advantage in the event of that region being threatened by an adversary from Europe. And Spikeman, He also wrote that many of the isolationists, and this is writing around the time of World War II or the lead up to beginning of World War II, accepted the policy of hemisphere defense because it seemed a way of avoiding conflict with Germany. But they overlooked the fact that even if the US could have avoided war with Germany over Europe, it could not have avoided a struggle with Germany for hegemony over South America. And just to quote a bit more from Kaplan, he said, there's no guarantee that the United States will remain the dominant power outside power in a region in which just under 20% of its trade is with the U.S. and the flying time from New York to Buenos Aires is 11 hours, the same time as it takes to fly from the U.S. to the Middle East. So this is a region where it's harder for America to maintain dominance, and it's a little less crucial to maintain dominance there than the Caribbean. But it's still an area that's close enough to that Caribbean basin and that America's Mediterranean that it needs to control, that a foreign power projecting power into southern Latin America is still a major threat. So this is still a region, even southern Latin America, getting away from the Caribbean, it's still a region that America really needs to be concerned about. America, a region that a foreign power could use to threaten the United States. And notice what Kaplan says, just summarizing that the potential for a foreign, and this time he's talking about Europe actually, could have in this region. He says, perhaps Spykman's most telling observation concerns Europe. Just as he is opposed to both German and Russian domination of Europe, he is also opposed to a united Europe under any circumstances. And he writes, Spykman writes that a federal Europe would constitute an agglomeration of force that would completely alter our significance as an Atlantic power and greatly weaken our position in the Western Hemisphere. And then adding to this, Kaplan writes, one can already see that the more united Europe becomes, the greater its tensions with the United States, a true European superstate with armed forces and a single foreign policy at its command, would be both a staunch competitor of the United States and possibly the dominant outside power in the equidistant zone of southern South America. So if you have a European Europe, they've got strong ties. They've got strong cultural ties with the region of Latin America. And it's very easy for them to go and to become the dominant outside power there. So a unified Europe would very quickly threaten the United States, and especially threaten the United States in this region. And this is something that we've long forecast at The Trumpet and at The Plain Truth before. Here are a couple of quotes that I just took from our He Was Right booklet that you heard the ad for over the break. In May 1962, The Plain Truth wrote that the United States is going to be left out in the cold as two gigantic trade blocs, Europe and Latin America, mesh together and begin calling the shots in world commerce. And then The Plain Truth in April 1966 wrote, can you see why we warn readers that the Latin American common market and the Central American common market are dangerously close to becoming partners with the European common market? Can you see that these giant combines are dangerously close to turning their backs on America and Britain once and for all? So this is exactly what we see. These powers then so close to the United States, drawing close to Europe, to China. And then throw in the Mart of Nations prophecy that we've talked about so much on this show. We've talked about Europe and China and really all of Asia forming this commercial alliance against the United States, laying siege to the United States. And the volume of trade that goes through this region in the Caribbean means that it is going to be a major part of this Mart of Nations and of this siege, of this blockade that's coming on the United States. We wrote an article in the Trumpet print magazine in, I think it was October 2005, something like that, maybe August 2000, or August 2015, that one specific promise to prophecy to consider in this context can be found in Deuteronomy 28. Among the punishments upon modern-day America that this chapter lists for rebellion against God, verse 52 warns that foreign nations shall besiege thee in all thy gates, in all your gates, until your high and fenced walls come down, wherein you trusted, throughout all your land. And he shall besiege you in your gates throughout all your land, which the Lord your God has given you. And these gates include those vital sea lanes, this article goes on, by which America trades and other nations imports goods that its people rely on every day. This is a specific prophecy that these sea lanes will be cut off by foreign powers. This scenario simply couldn't happen without Latin America. It will entail an enemy or alliance of enemies closing the Panama Canal to American traffic and gaining naval and aerial superiority in the Caribbean. And we've also warned repeatedly about the danger of America being attacked. Now, this is the real world. Nations attack each other, plot against each other. America's earlier presidents, they saw that. They took steps to stop it. Yet we don't want to think about that today. That's not how our leaders today think. But history even just tells us that a great power would, that if and when a great power wants to challenge America, wants to threaten America, attack America, that would probably come from Latin America and from the Caribbean region. Mr. Flores talked about how the main attack on the US would probably come from Cuba, from that region. So this watching of foreign powers getting involved in the Caribbean, in Cuba, in Latin America, is something hugely important for us to watch. So to read more on this really important subject, if you go on our website, thetrumpet.com, you can read our article, The Deadly Dangerous Cuba Deal. I will stick that up on the featured section on our front page. So if you go to the front page and just scroll down until it says featured shortly after this program, we'll have that article up there for you to click on and read. All the articles that we've quoted on and talked about are available on our website. You can read the He Was Right booklet by clicking on the literature request tab. Mr. Flurry, I believe, will be back again tomorrow. That's about it from me today. So tune in next time tomorrow. And if you have any comments, just email us at kpcg or td@kpcg.fm. Thanks for listening.